is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle Speak. Actually, Eagle One from Eagle Speak. Getting a little ahead of myself. I think I need more caffeine. But anyway... So that's the joys of live podcast. But hey, thanks everybody for joining us. As most of y'all know from seeing the pre-show advertisements, no guest today. This is our very rare and very special and very ad hoc pre-election special, where what we're going to do today, we're not here to tell you who to vote for or any of that foolishness. That's up to each individual to decide. But for a variety of reasons, I think everybody has noticed that this election season, national security and maritime issues have not been in the top 15 of any discussion items from either all the approved sources or the debates. But by golly, we're going to talk about it here anyway. And for those that are with us live, as usual, and we'll be paying more attention to it than usual, we have the chat room open. We've got Mr. Jack Noodles and Paul already there. If you scroll to the bottom of the show page, that's where the chat room is, and we will do our best to answer any questions or topics you wanted us to discuss during the course of the show. And if you are a little more extra versus introverted, if you'd like to call us directly and ask us a question yourself, our call-in number is area code 347-308-8397, 347-308-8397. If you didn't write it down, it's right there on the show page. That's where you'll find the number. We would love to hear from you. And just for full disclosure, for me, the election's already over because I already voted. I voted in person, and maybe I can give some more details later if we have any white space. But I don't think we won because my co-host I know is locked and loaded for today's show. Eagle One, a good afternoon.
Hey, Sal. How you doing today?
I'm happier than I deserve to be because as somebody who is also an empty nester, though you're a spawn or a little, quite a bit, not quite to a little, depending upon your point of view, older than me, I got to see both of my girls this week, so I have no reason to be anything but ecstatic. So that's my victory for the rest of October.
Well, that's not a bad victory at all, actually.
No, in the great scheme of things, it is. You know, what's fun is we used to do this with our girls when they were young, especially even when we lived overseas, because my wife and I, we always voted absentee overseas. And we would always get a sample ballot. And especially when you live overseas for a few years, you kind of lose the bubble on some of the local issues. So we would always converse with the folks back home and we would go over the ballot. And it's easier to do now, especially with the internet, but you can research some of the lower ballot issues. You know, who is John Smith and Jane Doe that are running for the Water and Soil Conservation District? I don't know, but you can find out a little bit more. So we did that. We went over the ballot with the folks, and some of us voted in person. The other ones, because they are my spawn, they don't trust anybody. They gave us the absentee ballot to put in the box at the polling place for them. So everybody in our household has done our civic duty. We didn't all vote the same. And in some places, we didn't share who we voted for because we don't make anybody tell anybody anything, at least in my family.
Yeah, it's a, I think it's a mixed bag. I mean, I'm pretty sure that my vote will cancel out somebody else's, no matter who I vote for. So, within my family, anyway. So,
I think it was, who was it? You might know. Maybe it was General Marshall, but there have been a few military people who said they never voted in elections, or, you know, they didn't want to have a bias, blah, blah, blah. I kind of understood the point they were making in theory, but I think the vote's too important for somebody to make that kind of stand, to make a message, not just our nation, but worldwide, even today. Untold millions of people have died just to have the ability to put who they want on a sheet of paper, and to this day, who knows how many people are languishing in jails simply because they wanted to have the right that every American who is of proper age and legal status can vote. So I think it's the least you can do, even if you write in your immediate superior in command as a write-in candidate. I just think it's something that, that folks should do. And I know your Navy experience is probably similar to mine. They always made an effort to get people in the commands that I served in to vote. And even if, you know, didn't guarantee that everybody would vote, but wanted to make sure I actually had this responsibility as a JO to make sure at least everybody got their nose touched so they could order an absentee if they wanted to. I think that's a pretty good tradition for our military is, you know, don't campaign in uniform. Don't be obnoxious about it with people that, that you work with and for. But in a very humble way, go out there and submit your ballot. Do your vote. That's, at the end of the day, I think that's what it's all about.
Yeah, I understand not voting, I guess, at some level, but I think that was a while ago when the defense establishment was a lot smaller, and in fact, our country was a lot smaller, and the government was a lot smaller. So it may have been more, maybe it was a more personal thing. Not to, hang on a second, I've got a big dog in here with me all of a sudden. okay.
No, we're a dog-friendly show, you know that.
Yeah, well, he's decided he wants to eat or something. I think that, you know, I can understand why they would do that, and maybe they thought it would somehow taint their image or their view of the person that was running the government, and so they didn't want to do that. But, you know, given the history of the number of military officers who ended up in political offices or in the presidency, or in, you know, Secretary of Defense or whatever, Secretary of State, I kind of think that, you know, that seems to be a kind of an old-fashioned way of looking at things, and I agree with you. Voting is everybody's right. You don't have to tell anybody who you voted for, and as long as you don't let it bleed over into how you view your superiors, I can't see any reason why you would not vote.
Yeah, and in some states, you know, the military is a not insignificant voting bloc. I know in Virginia, they had one thing on the ballot for a tax credit, or I think a tax avoidance, maybe is a better way of saying it, for the vehicle sales tax, which is hilarious. They don't have that in my state. And in Florida, there was an issue concerning property taxes and people who were 100% disabled. Those are small things here and there. I don't know if that's something that's worth voting about, but veterans issues are hard to avoid. And by the way, we had somebody who dialed in and then just hung up. Well, whoever you were, I think it was area code 253 or whatever that was. If you want to call in, be patient with us. We'll bring you back on. But, yeah, we almost had a caller, which can be kind of frightening. But that's okay. So, yeah, I voted, and it was kind of neat because when we showed up the in-person voting, there were five people deep. And then by the time we left, it was 70 yards deep, which isn't as bad as you think because of social distancing. But it was a beautiful day. Everybody was smiling. When you came out of the area of voting, that there were people from both political parties and both presidential candidates within yards of each other, smiling and waving at people driving by. I know in some parts of the country that it's hard to get people from one party or another within egg-throwing distance of each other. And it's kind of, maybe it's because where I live in a 50-50 area. This is not a predominantly one party or another area. It's consistently within, you know, 1 to 4 percentage points for each party. Everybody just learns to live and get along, but we've never had that type of partisan rancor here. I feel sorry for those people that are in parts of the country that are that way. I thought, getting to the topic at hand, we're not a poli-sci show, but that's okay. Let me ask you, I didn't ask you in the pre-show, so my apologies if this goes sideways, but I actually watched the last election, the last debate, and I thought on a couple of occasions we were going to have some national security issues raised, because I have my little happy list here of things that I was hoping one or two would be talked about, but it didn't really pan out that way. I don't know, Eagle One, were you expecting at least more than 2 minutes of that two-hour-long debate to be national security, or did you kind of expect it would go the way it went?
Well, I think that the reason it hasn't been discussed much is there's not a great deal of difference between the announced policies of either party, so that it doesn't, you know, it hasn't, it's not one of those things where you're, you know, you're so far against this or so much in favor of that. I mean, I'm old enough. I remember discussions of the missile gap and things like that, that, you know, things that were major issues. Right now we've got two candidates, both of whom say we want to get rid of, we want to get out of these endless wars. We want to, you know, obviously be smarter in the way we spend our defense money. You know, I mean, it's so there hasn't been any real controversy stirred up about national security, because either their policies are so close together, at least at this point, or that there is no controversy, or the difference is, if you're in the lead, I think, as Mr. Biden has been for a substantial part of this, at least in the polls, the policy is to just not say anything meaningful that you can be attacked for. So I think that there was no way that Mr. Trump could attack him on national security. And, you know, the major issues have been different than that, you know, economic and COVID-19 you know, all the other stuff that was brought up during the debates. So, no, in short, my answer is no, I was not surprised that it wasn't raised, because I just don't think it's been a major issue in this campaign so far.
Well, I guess in some ways, if he said that, well, maybe that's a positive for the last few years, that there isn't a national security crisis such that it breaks the background noise from everything else that's going on in the election. And maybe people can only be scared and insecure about one big thing at a time. And right now it's COVID-19. And when you look at the, lack of a better phrase, the national security terrain, you know, China, as we've talked about here quite often, it's an ongoing concern. When we looked 4 years ago, the Islamic State's caliphate was a serious issue and growing, but that was taken care of in fairly short order after the last election. Iraq and Afghanistan both break into the news now and then. They're both a mess, and I mean, that's, everybody's kind of numb to it to a certain extent. Russia, when you get past the political BS, Russia's kind of a little more adventurous than before, but no place we really care about. People will argue with you, but nobody cares about Syria. Nobody really cares about Libya. The other situations Russia has been involved in, it hasn't changed much either. And there are other areas, but one area I was hoping, because you're right, in some respects, in the big pixels, there isn't that much of a significant issue to break the two against, except for one area, and that's Iran. We've gone from an attitude that the way to get Iran to moderate its behavior is to get rid of sanctions and bring them pallets of cash and free up other money for them, to the old, I guess you're going to find out, Soleimani, we're going to we're going to hit you with a hellfire. Big difference between the two. And I think if there is a change of parties coming in November, that's one of the areas that you will probably see a change in attitude and tone in the national security arena, at least, is the posture towards Iran. I think good people can differ on that, but Iran's been a thorn in our side for over, good Lord Almighty, what, 40 years? And I think if nothing else, both the Republican and Democrat national security establishment should, if nothing else, take a humble pause to go before they do anything radical one way or the other, that we haven't read it right very often in 40 years. Maybe we should stop trying. I don't know. It's the Iranian situation, as I've mentioned a few times. It's kind of sad to me because, as many Americans have, I grew up around expat Iranians, an ancient culture, a great culture, great people. It's just sad to see a nation like that that's been where it has been the last 40 years. Hopefully they'll come out of it at some day. And then the biggest issue with Iran is how many pistachios the agricultural lobby from California will let them bring in. So we'll see.
Yeah, I think that if you back in March and April, I think it was, Mr. Biden had a piece in Foreign Affairs that he discussed what his policies were going to be. And yeah, he wants to get back together with Iran, and he would apparently reinvoke the treaty. That's one thing. The one argument I've seen that would suggest maybe, if I don't know if Iran will even agree to that. I mean, the caveat on that was that if Iran was actually abiding with the non-nuclear proliferation aspect of the treaty, then Biden would say, okay, well, we'll re-implement that policy. So you got. It's a pretty important if-then sequence there. The other thing is that in Biden's view, the relationship with our European allies in NATO and other things has been mistreated, and he would go back to some. If he could go back to some prior relationship where we're much more respectful of our allies and not so demanding, I guess. I'm not quite sure what the view is. And he also wants to continue to discuss things with North Korea. Now, a lot of these are not, these are not major. If we get along with our NATO allies or not, in the great scheme of things, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. And really, because we're still involved in Europe, and we're going to be involved in Europe, and everybody knows that. So it would be nice if they were cooperative with us and did do their fair share. But that's a low item on the totem pole, if you will. But the other side of it is that one assertion is being made, and that I've seen is that the hellfire on Salami, was that his name? Soleimani has caused a sudden cohesion in the Iranian government. So now they're where there was some tension between the IRGC and the putative government, that now that is kind of diminished, and they're all speaking with one voice, and now they're buddying up to Russia and to China, and that could be a potential problem. I don't know. I mean, I don't know why that situation has really changed that much for us, because we all knew that was a possibility. So, the questions that I come down to with respect to our defense issues and stuff is, are we going to make major cuts to defense in order to support expansion of our, I want to call it the welfare state, but the obligations to citizens that would be incurred under the vision that some members of the if this is if Biden wins, that some members of his party feel are more important than national defense, that we have enough national defense as it is, and we should be spending more money on the poor and whatever. That to me is a major difference in the two. Although, we are looking at a time now, even under the current administration, where we're looking at, well, we've got these enormous ships that cost us a lot of money, but we need to diversify our force quite a bit. How are we going to pay for that? Especially since it looks like, for the most part, we're not getting a sudden increase in defense dollars. We just have to use what we have a lot more wisely. So, is that kind of thinking incompatible with what would happen under a Biden administration? I'm not sure. I don't see. It may even be that these, again, this is just the same coin, same side of the coin, and just under different administrations. And a lot of it would depend on who comes in to be Secretary of Defense and who gets appointed to the other important jobs in the defense infrastructure. So that is probably worth discussing. I've seen Michelle Flournoy's name floated around quite a bit, and has a potential defense secretary, I think, under the Biden administration. But I'm sure there are other people out there that would be could be named, and that might be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, Michelle Flournoy, I think, is a big influencer, and I hadn't really thought about this, but I had a couple of folks I've bounced her ideas off in a possible Biden administration, and some of them have come back to me with a, do you have any idea how much money she's making right now? And evidently she's got a pretty good gig going with what she's doing. And, she has one of these two options. She could take a hell of a pay cut and go be SecDef for X amount of years. Who knows? And give up a lot of money, or keep making the cheese, but be what she is right now, which is an influencer, and help steer the conversation from a distance and help promote people into positions of authority. And I find negative things for both Biden and Trump should they win. And while we're on Flournoy, I'll do it. If Mr. Biden wins first, is Michelle Flournoy continues, and I mentioned a few mid-rats ago, I very, very, very much am concerned. This whole how we deter China is we show how we can defeat them inside of 72 hours. I'm sorry, that's one of the most irresponsible and dangerous strategic concepts that's been around since we decided we don't need conventional forces. We're just going to nuke everybody back until the Korean War took place. That's one hell of an assumption, because what happens on the 73rd hour when the Chinese go, I kind of hurt, but I have plans C, D, E, F, and G, and I want to do those. How's your bunker looking? How many more of those precision weapons you have? Because I don't think you have that many, so let's come in here and we'll do it hand to hand. It just I find that to be fraught with risk, and it has a little bit of an odor of arrogance to it, which has never done us very, very well. If President Trump winds up getting reelected, at least from the naval point of view, I'm not real optimistic either, regardless of what was said before the 2016 election. Where we are here in 2020, you do not have a DOD postured to grow the Navy. You have the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, who is ridiculously partisan when it comes to the Army and the land war area, West Point guy. I guess it's in his blood. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Miley, is no counterweight to that. For things that we've discussed over the course of the last few years, the Navy has decided that it wanted to step on all the different variety of rakes they could find over at Lowe's, and then decided to make it better that they would short sheet the president and piss him off on a few, you got to pick your battles. And we picked a few battles that in hindsight and at the time were like, okay, I get it's worth it. So if President Trump gets a second term, if there's not a significant change at the front, I don't see how that changes in any huge measure. And on the Democrat side of the House, if they continue to hold the House and if they take the Senate, or the Senate's 50-50, I don't see the political desire or leadership in the Hill that will either grow the defense budget or will give a bigger pie to the Navy. I know uncharacteristically for me to say whichever way you look, be sad. I think there might be a couple places for optimism, but there are a few things, and I actually have something I'll publish after the election. It's an idea. But it's not going to happen overnight. And I think that the die is cast for the rest of this decade. If you want things to start to change, there's an opportunity in the next few years to start doing things that can set the conditions for a better maritime and aerospace-focused security environment, which I think is better set to what this nation needs. But for now, I think there are two different types of uncomfortable, regardless of what happens. But that is also a challenge. That tells me in some ways that in the great and storied and well-funded think tanks, academic institutions, and to be blunt, our war, quote, colleges, unquote, we've been doing a lousy job informing decision makers, because ultimately it's the civilians who need to understand the issues well and can ask the right questions. And if we find ourselves in a spot of bother from a structure or a national strategy point of view, the national security nomenclatura has therefore done a bad job. So I guess there's a lot of blame to go around. Maybe some new voices can appear and start a better conversation. We've had a few young national security voices come on Midrats during the course of the years who are still in their 20s and early 30s. Maybe we need to bring some of those people on board, regardless of which political party they work for, to kind of break some new conversations.
Yeah, I think that the... I mean, you get into a fundamental difference. I'm going to talk about funding the military, because you get a fundamental difference between the the strategy of we're going to grow the economy. If we grow the economy, then we'll have enough money to pay for a defense buildup, however slight it might be. I mean, I don't know how many dollars we're talking about if we're going to increase the defense budget. Or you have the other side of the coin, which is we've got all these other domestic concerns. I mean, right now it's for the Democrats and their world, it has to do with expanded health care coverage, subsidized college tuition, clean energy assistance, child care, elder care, you know, the whole litany of and Biden has said in his foreign affairs piece that I quoted earlier is that the major national security issue facing us is climate change. And the last time we addressed climate change in the Navy, we went with this green fleet, magic fuel grown from moss or something, and algae maybe, I don't even know. And that costs a lot of money, and it's unnecessary as long as we continue to have fracking and other things that allow us to produce our resources domestically. But the other approach to avoiding international entanglement is to go, well, how much green sustainment can we have in our country? Is that provide enough jobs if we go, you know, we all go to electric cars and we go to more solar panels and windmills and God forbid we would use nuclear power, which is about as green as you can get. But, you know, that's another way. If you reduce your need for foreign fuels and stuff, then you don't have to be entangled in things like the Middle East. I find it really a fascinating problem where, you know, what are the, and I kind of look at England after World War II, actually, when they shifted from their wartime economy to trying to take care of the domestic things that had been built up over the war period from 39 to 45 for them, they went into this and they elected a socialist government, and all of a sudden, you know, they had Medicare or medical stuff for everybody, but the drains on the economy were huge. And, you know, you have to balance that out and look at it. And, you know, one of the things you look at with the people have suggested with the Democrat platform is that they would cut defense. I think their platform, which I don't know if platforms make any difference, said we can maintain a strong defense, protect our safety and security for less. Well, that implies a cut, and what would be the cut? 2%, and if it's 2%, is that, and you allow for inflation, is that a 4% real dollar cut? And where would that come from? And they're also looking really hard at this overseas contingency operation budget, which is it's funding a lot of things that probably weren't involved with overseas contingency operations, but you know, it is a big chunk of money, and we wish they would focus as much on getting rid of fraud, waste, and abuse in some of these social welfare programs, but you know, that's just me. Anyway, the point is that somewhere along the line here, we're going to run into some budget crunches, one from one side or the other, and the issue is what's your approach to funding that the government. One side seems to be saying we'll grow the economy. When we grow the economy, there are more jobs. More jobs mean more tax revenue. The other side says we'll grow jobs through these domestic programs that are green in nature, and that'll be good too. And that's where you walk that very thin line of, well, I'm not a good of an economist to figure out which way works, but you know that's the line that's being drawn. Social welfare benefits, or at the cost of some national defense funding, and the risk of trying to convert too fast from an economy based on petroleum to a large extent to one based on these other sustainable resources.
Yeah, just, I wanted to touch on the climate change issue before, because it's funny you mentioned that. And it makes sense because Mr. Biden did bring that up. Had a few interactions, it's very typical, one of which was from an individual who had a not insignificant position during the second Obama administration. And and I don't mean this to insult anybody, but it's kind of the way it's being treated. The climate change issue has become a secular religion. It has a lot of the undertones of religion, blasphemy, rites and rituals, words that have to be said. And so, unfortunately, a lot of times things can spin out of control. And I had people in the national security arena come out of left field and threw that in my face over a comment I made on a separate issue. But in many ways, I think the climate change issue is an excuse to go after the defense budget, because climate change is like discussing the rise and fall of the sun. It's always going to happen. It's been happening. You know, it always will be. There is no perfect position of the sun. It's always moving. There's no perfect position for the climate, because the climate's always changing. The question is, how much of that change is being made by humans? And that's where there's no agreement on. Is it 0.5% or is it 50%? People argue left, right, and sideways. And when people talk about climate change, if they really believe that, and if they believe that it's a hydrocarbon, human consumption of hydrocarbons, then why aren't they working with China and India? Because the U.S. is not, in Western Europe, especially France, who uses a lot of nuclear, is not the problem. And that's always my test, is what is their take on China and India, and what's their take on nuclear? And depending upon their response there, I let them know whether they are honest believers in this new secular religion, which is takes a conversation one place, or if this is just another political cudgel they want to use to slap people around because they're horrible people, and that gets a different response. One group of people I'm happy to engage and talk with because I can learn things. The other group of people bore me to no end. But that is a way to decrease the defense budget. And as we've talked about before, I think, or I hope at least, that there are smart people who have a few plans on what to do with that budget crunch, because the lazy way of doing it is just telling everybody, you know, take your salami slice. You know, you're going to have an equal share of the pie, just your cut of the pie is going to be slightly less. That hasn't been the most optimal thing in the world. I also think that there are certain retired military people who have, you know, clearly become partisan in the last few years. I hope that they will use their new friendships, if we do have a Biden administration, to make a good argument, to bring some coherence to what's going to be an ugly battle. We kind of have an idea of who's on the naughty and nice list in the Trump administration right now in the national security arena. And when I say that, I mean the Department of State, DOD, National Security Council, that little triangle. The Biden administration, as you mentioned earlier, it's a little less known who's going to be there. It's, you know, you gotta buy the box before you can open it to find out what's in it. But that kind of signals to me that there's no big idea, big concept, that a lot of the efforts, at least for the first couple of years, will be trying to return as many things as possible to what they were, where they left off. Because I think a lot of those people that step in will be those who already had their office assignments, their cell phones, and their briefing binders for the Hillary Clinton administration. So they'll pick up where they dropped off. And so we'll have a little bit of a zombie issue going on, unless there's some outside shock, until whoever is appointed to the really high profile that have significant levers of power in a new administration, if Mr. Biden is elected, takes place. I think if Mr. Trump, President Trump, however you want to refer to him, if he is given another term, I think there might be a little bit of a house cleaning like you usually see, and we'll just have to see who that next team is. I don't know. But when you look at the budgetary issues and the fact that it's national security has just faded a bit, I don't think those some good friends of ours who have dreams of a huge Navy with all these sparkling, sexy new technologies that by 2030 will have us be closer to a half a grand than a quarter grand in ship numbers. I think they're set for great disappointment if that's what they're hanging their hopes on.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that unless somebody comes in, you know, and part of it I think we've discussed is the is this loving jointness that has now, I think, outlived somewhat its usefulness. You've proposed at various times that we take a hard look at this huge standing army we have, which sucks up a lot of money, that could be used to build a large standing Navy. But and we have to look at, you know, I mean, the Army doesn't go anywhere without the Air Force and the Navy kind of paving the way, and especially the Navy, and that is of concern. And, you know, I think that some Secretary of Defense at some point is going to look and say, well, and I think you raised this many years ago, perhaps we need to increase the size of the Army Reserve and National Guard, which costs, I know the Naval Reservist costs, I think, a tenth, or maybe it's a quarter of what it costs, maybe a third of what it costs for an active duty person. But you can reduce the personnel costs, which are one of the biggest costs in the service, by putting people in reserves and National Guard. They can still get paid. They can hold other jobs, and they can maintain high levels of training. But you can't. It's harder to do that, as we've discussed recently, with ships. You can't really put at reservists on frontline ships and expect them to run the ships on a consistent basis. It's just too hard for that to work. So your Navy needs to be largely active duty. And I would think that one of the things they ought to be looking at is if you had an honest look at where we are in defenses, you know, when's the next time we're going to need to roll out however many M1 tanks we have on a large assault anywhere. And if we're not going to do that in the near future, what can we do to have the kind of force that needs to be light enough and mobile enough to get where we need them when we need them, and then we can bring all the heavy stuff on later on if that's needed by activating the reserves and guard. That is a difficult conversation that I wish we would have, and I don't see that in either party's platform.
Yeah, that's kind of just because I love our loyal Midrats listeners, some of which have been with us for a decade. I'll give them a little preview. That's one of the cornerstones of the bit that I'm going to put out in the weeks after the election. It's when you're faced with a tough situation, as greater people than me have said, you can curl up in a ball or you can go, this is an opportunity. All you can hope for, though, is the people that hold the lever of power are more the latter and not the former. It can be very empowering to find yourself in a crisis situation. That's how I got through college. I need a motivation to study. I can't prepare the entire semester. It's much better to do the 48-hour rush. I guess that's the Michelle Flournoy School of Academic Accomplishment. I can do a semester in 72 hours. I don't need to do the hard work. But that type of motivation, I think, is helpful. And part of that might be, one way or another, I think we are at an inflection point here. I was thinking about a lot of problems that the present administration has had has been some of the best our best is a subjective point. Let me make a more objective point. A lot of the more experienced national security people who had traditionally served in Republican administrations signed that Never Trump letter and took them out of circulation. So it took a while to find people to fill positions, and they had to reach some unusual locations to do that. When you look at the average age of the person there, they some of them might find a job in the Biden administration, but if there's a second Trump administration, it's going to be a long winter for the folks on that list. Some of them might find an opportunity to work on some people working for 2024, but a lot of them, frankly, they've aged out. I think you're going to see a very large cleansing of the baby boomer national security cohort that has been deeply involved in defense, state, national security issues really since Bush 41's election. They're going to be at retirement age. A lot of them could still work, but a lot of them probably don't want to. They're ready to retire. And you have a huge, not a huge, but a pressure-filled bow wave of Gen X, older cohort millennials who in 4 years or so are really going to want to step forward. Now, you know what? That's a different life experience. The Gen X's were, the older cohort at least, were in their early 20s when the Berlin Wall fell. They've been very much dominated by the long war since 2001. Everybody younger has known nothing else. And on the Democrat side of the House, I think you've already seen some of that. The circle around Hillary Clinton, they're more or less gone. You see Senator Kerry out there stepping on rakes, but many of his Vietnam era, they also, they're not in the top tier anymore. So you might start to see that transition if Mr. Biden wins coming up, but you'll definitely see it in 2024. But I think that's the long winter, that last group of the baby boomer national security people who have felt entitled since the end of the Cold War to run policy. They're not going to be the presence they once were. I haven't really thought about the implications of that, and I haven't read anything where people have thought about that, because generational perspectives matter. I think the fetish, for lack of a phrase, and I'm a NATO guy, I love the NATO alliance, but you can read with some people when they write about NATO, it's as if it's 1987 still, and it's not. There's a different perspective and view on the alliance, international relations, traditional and new partners, that I think that generational change can bring about. I just don't know what it's going to be. I just know it's going to be there.
Yeah, I read a pretty good piece by Kevin Williamson in National Review this morning, as a matter of fact, about what will happen to this is sort of along those lines. What will happen to the Republican Party if Trump loses and the coalition that he sort of doesn't have of the Republicans, which are in two different groups. You know, there's the kind of the classic conservative, which would be classic liberal. Our government's good, we're for freedom, all that stuff. And there's another group that is sort of nativistic and more oriented toward the safety and security of their neighborhoods today than worried about global affairs. And, you know, whether those two things those two groups can continue in the same party is somewhat in question. And that that could be a big change that an election would bring about, and that would also have serious impacts on national security issues. And you're right, there should be a passing of the torch from people my age to the younger generations and let them deal with all this stuff. But, you know, it's really, really hard, as you can tell from the fact that Nancy Pelosi has decided to run again as for Speaker of the House, to give up power when you've got it. And of all the stuff that you see, all the kind of semi, that is not semi, all the corruption of position and granting of favors and access and all that, and the price we pay for it in not having the, you know, a good, honest government, that is power, and that's something that my generation, now that they've had it for a long time, I think they're going to have to pry it loose from their cold, dead hands almost to get not the AOC generation, but the generation you're talking about, the senior millennials and the group right after them, whatever that is. But I think power is the main thing, and we all know it's a tremendous corruptor.
It is, and I don't know if it's corruption as much as habits. And I kind of used the phrase before. I'm not the only one to use it, but there's kind of a zombie approach to some issues because people have been arguing them for so long. Some people are pretty nimble, but some of the stuff that I've read, especially about an attitude towards Iran and the attitude towards Russia, really seems just like they took something they wrote 14 years ago, changed the date, you know, changed happy to glad and published it again. Stuff has changed. And if nothing else, I think the last 20 years has taught us that we don't know what we think we know. There's a lot more nuance. And we're not as powerful is not the right word. We don't have the ability to bend other nations to our will with the way power is exerted today. You know, it's one thing to take an advanced and very unique nation and culture such as Japan and write their constitution when you've nuked and burned most of their cities to the ground and have millions of their men under arrest than it is trying to do it via soft power. It's a different way of looking at things, and not to mention the financial situation that we're in is going to cause us to not go to some of the usual habits we've usually gone to. There's a small number of people, and there's some facts on the ground that gives them some purchase to grab hold of, who think it's just a matter of time that China's going to break apart because of its own internal contradictions. I don't think so. I think the Chinese are very aware of their challenges, and they're being very proactive about it. I think they were very aware of the challenge being posed by relatively small Uyghur minority out west, and the Chinese are being very Chinese about it. And the international community has either been bought off, scared off, or is aggressively indifferent about what the Chinese are doing to the Uyghurs. And again, everybody should read their Hopkirk, and Peter Hopkirk covered in quite a few of his books the history of that part of what is now Western China and Tibet, wasn't always. And that can be a thorn in the side to the emperor in the east. I don't think the Chinese is going to make our job easy by blowing themselves up, for lack of a better phrase. I don't think history is going to be that lucky to us. We've been too lucky of a country for too long. I think we may have run out of cards, at least as far as China's challenge goes.
Yeah, I think you're right. The history of China is, you know, control from, to the extent you control a country that size, the control from the central government in Beijing, they ruthlessly suppress any dissent, and they've got the tools to suppress things they don't like, and they don't hesitate to use them, and their aggressive diplomacy, I can't remember what they call it anymore, but you know, they're not taking anybody. They will snap back at people. So if they tell Canada, if you keep harping about something, we're going to, you know, detain all your Canadian citizens here in China. You know, that's not a country that is willing to play with the rule book that the West has operated under for so many years. We see it with their reaction to Taiwan. You know, Taiwan to them is a breakaway province, and what they do with that would be the equivalent of if Alabama seceded again, in their view, and we fought to bring it back. That's exactly what they feel about Taiwan. That they would be like dragging Alabama back into the country that they seceded from. You know, they operate their way. They have a long-term view of things, and they're used to having a central focus, whether it's the emperor or with his minions out in all the fields, all the mandarins and all that, which is, boy, I swear they're recreating that history as fast as they can. And as long as the middle class and the upper classes are wealthy enough, whatever that number is, wealthy enough, and they stay that way, I don't see much way that they're going to break, that country is going to break apart, especially the way that anybody who sticks their head up too high gets pounded back pretty rapidly. And that is a national security issue.
And you know, when you look at it, I don't know who is really going to stand against China doing what she wants to do. Russia just wants to be respected. Europe just wants to be left alone. In many regards, we don't have any interests really to speak of on the areas that border China, though people can make moral cases. I don't think you can walk over to your average family and say your mother or daughter, husband, wife, son, needs to put their life and treasure on the line for the Uyghurs or for the Tibetans or for the Russians in Eastern Mongolia or whatever is the area around Vladivostok that used to be Chinese till 150 years ago. The Chinese, you know, what do the Chinese want? I think the Chinese want what they think that they, as we've talked about here, if you, you know, want to look at it in really big pixels, they want what they think they've been denied and was justly theirs as being 1/4 to 1/5 of the world's population. They want respect. They want money. They want influence. And that's about it. And how are people going to react to that? And I think the little slap and tickle on the Indian border is probably the big friction point that China's going to have. Nobody really knows. But we've talked about it here. I still have my money. At some point, modern China is going to announce their place on the stage in a military manner. Don't know who the opponent's going to be. I don't know what it's going to be over, but they're going to pick their place in time. And it'll hopefully at that point, we'll have the leaders in place that will make the right call. what, if any, play that we're going to have in that confrontation if it doesn't involve us. And if it does involve us, then hopefully we've been doing what we were supposed to do to prepare, because I don't think America or the world is ready for America's decline to be less than relative but actual. And that's what would happen if we got our backside handed to us in a conflict with the Chinese, regardless of where it is. So I hope the smart people are making the right decisions, because as a nation, we haven't been there before.
Yeah, I hope you're right. There's one thing we didn't discuss about the Biden administration should they get elected, and that's the possibility of the invocation of the 25th Amendment. Just kind of putting out the possibility that we would have a President Harris, an unknown quantity in national security issues, I think.
Well, let's give 5 minutes for that, because I think that's a great point. Speaking of Speaker Pelosi, when she talked a few weeks ago about how the House is going to set up something involving the 25th Amendment, I saw a couple people, their immediate thing was, oh, God, they're going after Trump. And other people saw the same thing I did. It was like, no, that's setting the condition for Biden. Because there are a lot of people on both sides of the political spectrum, and I think good people can disagree on this, and we'll all find out before the end of the new year. I didn't say by the end of the X number of weeks. By the end of the new year, we'll know who our new president will be. But there are a lot of people who think it's going to be Biden, and there are a lot of people that have concerns about President Biden, should that be the phrase is going to be used in 2021, if he has the ability to make it to 2024. And if they activate the 25th Amendment, this country will be so incredibly distracted. There will be political instability, lack of faith in institution, lack of faith in parties. Its input or impact on DOD might be a secondary or tertiary effect to larger issues internally, especially if it's something that Biden disagrees with, which, if you look at the 25th Amendment process, I'll defer to the legal minds in my sphere of influence to give the details, but it's something that can be contested. And if you have one political party that is split between a House and a Senate, and another political party that, you can play your scenario, what will happen to the Republicans in the upcoming election, one way or the other. Again, good people can differ. You talk about Belgian level of instability at the highest reaches. If I was somebody on the world stage that wanted to make a move, that'd be a great opportunity to do it, because sure as hell, it would, unless it was a direct attack on us as a nation, it would be really hard for a President Biden or a presumptive President Harris to make a case to the American people they need to get involved in another foreign entanglement when they can't disengage from a domestic entanglement. I will say this while you brought up the topic. I don't think we've really touched on this, but let me go ahead and put down this marker. One of the most disappointing, and some of these people have been guests on this show, and I won't name them because that's not what I'm about. One of the most disappointing things I've seen in the last year, people who should know better, people who once wore the uniform, people who are retired officers, have made implications about what the U.S. military might or might not do during a civilian constitutional crisis. I was angry as opposed to disappointed, because I do not think these individuals, some of whom have PhDs and have spent decades around the military officer corps, could in any way see how the U.S. military could be involved in any type of civilian political wrangling. I have very few absolute beliefs. I'm willing to be convinced about a lot of things. But in time, I've become very firm, for me at least, it's black and white. We do not have that tradition in our military. Our military is not designed to do that. It will not happen. Now, what civilian law enforcement organizations might do, I have no idea. But anybody who thinks that there's going to be some type of tank division, cavalry unit that's going to make the decision about who ultimately is going to be carrying the nuclear football is incredibly irresponsible, and they're unnecessarily worrying the civilian population who doesn't have the background to know what an incredible impossibility that is. And I just, is the worst type of electoral fear-mongering. So for, at least for me, and I'll speak for myself alone here, shame on everybody who did that, who should know better, regardless of what political stripe you wear. I just thought that was the most disappointing thing I've seen in a long time for people I used to share a uniform with.
Yeah, I support you in that, and I'll raise you one. We need to stop this pretty soon, but let me raise you one. Everybody who is talking about going to the streets after the election, and I don't care who wins or loses the election, but anybody who's talking about going to the streets and engaging in some kind of violence as a result of the election needs to rethink that position. That is the mark of a third world country. And I've been in a few third world countries when those kinds of things happen. Nobody wins in that deal. It would be a domestic horror show, and laying the seeds for that, as some of these groups have been doing, and their groups, I don't want to say they're good people on both sides, but there are groups on both sides who are having this sort of discussion. There are groups that I don't know where they came from, what their background is, but I certainly hope that nobody's really paying attention to what these people are saying, and that if that either side does that after the election, that they get quashed as fast as possible. That is just a huge mistake.
Amen. I'm in full alignment with you there. And on that perfect note, I guess we'll call it a day. We went a little bit over, but you brought up an important topic, and I think it's good that we put that marker down. And for everybody, we're going to have a best of next week, because everybody's mind is going to be focused on other things. But we'll see you at the other end of the election, whichever side you want to vote for. Just go ahead and vote. Otherwise, you have no right to complain. And Eagle One, it's been a great hour, as always, and we'll talk to you on the other side.
All right. Take care. Everybody have a good week or so.
You too. And, hey, Maggie, it's great to see you in the chat room, too. I couldn't go by without saying. And Jack and Paul, thanks for sticking with us in the chat room, and everybody else. And, hey, until after the election, I hope you have a great series of Navy days. Cheers.
Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, little.